The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing with the introduction, Chapter 4, The Systems of Yoga, page 31. These relations between the different psychological divisions of the human being and these various utilities and objects of effort founded on them, such as we have seen them in our brief survey of the natural evolution, we shall find repeated in the fundamental principles and methods of the different schools of yoga. And if we seek to combine and harmonize their central practices and their predominant aims, we shall find that the basis provided by nature is still our natural basis and the condition of their synthesis. In one respect, yoga exceeds the normal operation of cosmic nature and climbs beyond her. For the aim of the Universal Mother is to embrace the divine in her own play and creations and there to realize it. But in the highest flights of yoga, she reaches beyond herself and realizes the divine in itself, exceeding the universe and even standing apart from the cosmic play. Therefore, by some it is supposed that this is not only the highest, but also the one true or exclusively preferable object of yoga. Yet it is always through something which she has formed in her evolution that nature thus overpasses her evolution. It is the individual heart that by sublimating its highest and purest emotions attains to the transcendent bliss or the ineffable nirvana. The individual mind that by converting its ordinary functionings into a knowledge beyond mentality knows its oneness with the ineffable and merges its separate existence in that transcendent unity. And always it is the individual, the self, conditioned in its experience by nature and working through her formations, that attains to the self unconditioned, free, and transcendent. In practice, three conceptions are necessary before there can be any possibility of yoga. There must be, as it were, three consenting parties to the effort: God, nature, and the human soul, or, in more abstract language, the transcendental, the universal, and the individual. If the individual and nature are left to themselves, the one is bound to the other and unable to exceed appreciably her lingering march. Something transcendent is needed, free from her and greater, which will act upon us and her, attracting us upward to itself and securing from her, by good grace or by force, her consent to the individual ascension. It is this truth which makes necessary to every philosophy of yoga the conception of the Ishwara, Lord, Supreme Soul, or Supreme Self, towards whom the effort is directed, and who gives the illuminating touch and the strength to attain. Equally true is the complementary idea so often enforced by the yoga of devotion, that as the transcendent is necessary to the individual and sought after by him, so also the individual is necessary, in a sense, to the transcendent, and sought after by it. If the bhakta seeks and yearns after Bhagavan, Bhagavan also seeks and yearns after the bhakta. Bhakta, the devotee or lover of God, Bhagavan, God, the Lord of love and delight. The third term of the Trinity is Bhagavat, the divine revelation of love. There can be no yoga of knowledge without a human seeker of the knowledge, the supreme subject of knowledge, and the divine use by the individual of the universal faculties of knowledge. No yoga of devotion without the human God lover, the supreme object of love and delight, and the divine use by the individual of the universal faculties of spiritual, emotional, and aesthetic enjoyment. No yoga of works without the human worker, the supreme will, master of all works and sacrifices, and the divine use by the individual of the universal faculties of power and action. However monistic may be our intellectual conception of the highest truth of things, in practice, we are compelled to accept this omnipresent Trinity. For the contact of the human and individual consciousness with the divine is the very essence of yoga. Yoga is the union of that which has become separated in the play of the universe with its own true self, origin, and universality. The contact may take place at any point of the complex and intricately organized consciousness which we call a personality. It may be affected in the physical through the body, in the vital through the action of those functionings which determine the state and the experiences of our nervous being, through the mentality, whether by means of the emotional heart, the active will, or the understanding mind, or more largely, by a general conversion of the mental consciousness in all its activities. It may equally be accomplished through a direct awakening to the universal or transcendent truth and bliss by the conversion of the central ego in the mind. And, according to the point of contact that we choose, will be the type of the yoga that we practice. For, if leaving aside the complexities of their particular processes, we fix our regard on the central principle of the chief schools of yoga, still prevalent in India, we find that they arrange themselves in an ascending order, which starts from the lowest rung of the ladder, the body, and ascends to the direct contact between the individual soul and the transcendent and universal self. Hatha Yoga selects the body and the vital functionings as its instruments of perfection and realization. Its concern is with the gross body. Raja Yoga selects the mental being in its different parts as its lever power. It concentrates on the subtle body. The triple path of works, of love, and of knowledge uses some part of the mental being, will, heart, or intellect, as a starting point, and seeks by its conversion to arrive at the liberating truth, beatitude, and infinity, which are the nature of the spiritual life. Its method is a direct commerce between the human Purusha in the individual body and the divine Purusha who dwells in every body and yet transcends all form and name. Hatha Yoga aims at the conquest of the life and the body whose combination in the food sheath and the vital vehicle constitutes, as we have seen, the gross body, and whose equilibrium is the foundation of all nature's workings in the human being. The equilibrium established by nature is sufficient for the normal egoistic life. It is insufficient for the purpose of the Hatha Yogin. for it is calculated on the amount of vital or dynamic force necessary to drive the physical engine during the normal span of human life, and to perform more or less adequately the various workings demanded of it by the individual life inhabiting this frame, and the world environment by which it is conditioned. Hatha Yoga therefore seeks to rectify nature and establish another equilibrium by which the physical frame will be able to sustain the inrush of an increasing vital or dynamic force of prana, indefinite, almost infinite in its quantity or intensity. In nature, the equilibrium is based upon the individualization of a limited quantity and force of the prana. More than that, the individual is by personal and hereditary habit unable to bear, use, or control. In Hatha Yoga, the equilibrium opens a door to the universalization of the individual vitality by admitting into the body, containing, using, and controlling a much less fixed and limited action of the universal energy. The chief processes of Hatha Yoga are asana and pranayama. By its numerous asanas, or fixed postures, it first cures the body of that restlessness which is a sign of its inability to contain, without working them off in action and movement, the vital forces poured into it from the universal life ocean, gives to it an extraordinary health, force, and suppleness, and seeks to liberate it from the habits by which it is subjected to ordinary physical nature and kept within the narrow bounds of her normal operations. In the ancient tradition of Hatha Yoga, it has always been supposed that this conquest could be pushed so far even as to conquer to a greater extent the force of gravitation. By various subsidiary but elaborate processes, the Hatha Yoga next contrives to keep the body free from all impurities and the nervous system unclogged for those exercises of respiration which are his most important instruments. These are called pranayama, the control of the breath, or vital power. For breathing is the chief physical functioning of the vital forces. Pranayama for the Hatha Yogin serves a double purpose. First, it completes the perfection of the body. The vitality is liberated from many of the ordinary necessities of physical nature, robust health, prolonged youth, often an extraordinary longevity, are attained. On the other hand, pranayama awakens the coiled-up serpent of the pranic dynamism in the vital sheath and opens to the yogin fields of consciousness, ranges of experience, abnormal faculties denied to the ordinary human life, while it puissantly intensifies such normal powers and faculties as he already possesses. These advantages can be farther secured and emphasized by other subsidiary processes open to the Hatha Yogin. The results of Hatha Yoga are thus striking to the eye and impose easily on the vulgar or physical mind. And yet, at the end, we may ask what we have gained at the end of all this stupendous labor. The object of physical nature, the preservation of the mere physical life, its highest perfection, even in a certain sense the capacity of a greater enjoyment of physical living, have been carried out on an abnormal scale. But the weakness of Hatha Yoga is that its laborious and difficult processes make so great a demand on the time and energy and impose so complete a severance from the ordinary life of men that the utilization of its results for the life of the world becomes either impracticable or is extraordinarily restricted. If in return for this loss we gain another life in another world within, the mental, the dynamic, these results could have been acquired through other systems, through Raja Yoga, through Tantra, by much less laborious methods, and held on much less exacting terms. On the other hand, the physical results increased vitality, prolonged youth, health, longevity, are of small avail if they must be held by us as misers of ourselves, apart from the common life, for their own sake, not utilized, not thrown into the common sum of the world's activities. Hatha Yoga attains large results, but at an exorbitant price and to very little purpose. Raja Yoga takes a higher flight. It aims at the liberation and perfection not of the bodily, but of the mental being, the control of the emotional and sensational life, the mastery of the whole apparatus of thought and consciousness. It fixes its eyes on the citta, that stuff of mental consciousness in which all these activities arise, and it seeks, even as Hatha Yoga with its physical material, first to purify and to tranquilize. The normal state of man is a condition of trouble and disorder, a kingdom either at war with itself or badly governed, for the Lord, the Purusha, is subjected to his ministers, the faculties, subjected even to his subjects, the instruments of sensation, emotion, action, enjoyment. Swarajya, self-rule, must be substituted for this subjection. First, therefore, the powers of order must be helped to overcome the powers of disorder. The preliminary movement of Raja Yoga is a careful self-discipline by which good habits of mind are substituted for the lawless movements that indulge the lower nervous being. By the practice of truth, by renunciation of all forms of egoistic seeking, by abstention from injury to others, by purity, by constant meditation and inclination to the Divine Purusha, who is the true Lord of the mental kingdom, a pure, glad, clear state of mind and heart is established.